This is Central Time. Flu season is off to a rough start. Cases are more than 12 times higher than they were in the fall of 2019 before the pandemic. That's according to some national numbers from the CDC. About five times as many people have been hospitalized so far than at the same point in any of the last 10 flu seasons. We're talking about the flu season, why it's already looking bad, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you seek out a flu shot? Yet, anyway, have you had the flu this year? If you work in healthcare, are you seeing a lot of cases of the flu and RSV as well coming through your door? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway is a pediatric infectious disease specialist with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Conway, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back with you, Rob.
I gave a couple national numbers there. What are we seeing when it comes to the flu here in Wisconsin so far?
Yeah, our numbers are pretty much mimicking what we're seeing around the country, but actually it hasn't even really hit here nearly as much as it has been hitting in the southern United States and along the eastern seaboard. We're gradually increasing, but pretty rapidly. We're certainly ahead of where we are most years, and I think that's what's got people most concerned, is that this curve is really going up and going up quite quickly.
Is this early for flu season? I think of it peaking, I guess, late in the year and then through January and February.
Yeah, it started out as an early season. You know, I think that you're right that the majority of the last 20 years, the peaks happen in January and February. But there are certainly some years where we have early seasons like we're having now. There's also seasons that, you know, start up fairly late. And so that's one of the reasons that we need to track this so closely, because this is certainly shaping up to be a rough one if it continues this way throughout the entire season.
Of course, over the last couple of years, this time of year, COVID has been the big story, and it's still around. Do you think we maybe are taking our eye off the ball when it comes to the flu, as far as, you know, being worried about catching what we might now think of as a lesser ailment?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think you're right. I think people have been so focused on COVID that they've sort of forgotten about both RSV and flu, both of which are bad actors. I think we're also seeing the impact of people lifting a lot of the mitigation that they've been doing. You know, we learned that masks and keeping apart and staying home when you're sick works really well for COVID, but it actually worked really well for RSV and flu too. And then there's this idea of this immune debt that we're paying back, that because people didn't get exposed to these things, there's not a whole lot of herd immunity out there that was caused by natural infection. And so we're really only dependent on vaccines, and vaccine rates, unfortunately, are running behind where they usually are this time of year.
I wanted to ask about the vaccines. I know every year there's kind of a prediction going on what are most likely to be the strains of influenza that come to us here in Wisconsin or around the country, I guess. How well do our vaccines match up with the strains that are driving up these numbers?
Yeah, interestingly, surprisingly, we actually hit it really right on the head this year. So far, you know, the majority of what's circulating is an H3N2 influenza A, and the vaccine strain is really a good match for what's circulating. So for people that are vaccinated, they actually are really very well protected. We have to remember that, you know, there's four different strains in the vaccines each year, two different strains of A and two different strains of B, and we usually expect to see at least a couple of them show up. So early season tends to be A, and then later season tends to be B. But so far, this is shaping up to be a very good match with the vaccines that are available.
Now, let's talk about kids and influenza. Kids were at less risk, not zero risk, but less risk than older people for COVID. Influenza, though, how much of a concern is it for younger folks?
Yeah, I think there's two big features. One is that they really do serve as the epicenter for transmission. You know, we've certainly learned that schools are a great place to transmit viruses, and then they can bring it home and share it with others. But kids also do have pretty significant disease when they can get flu. You know, many of them are fairly naive. They haven't seen flu before, and so they don't really have much immunity. And when they get it, they can get it pretty badly. We've already had a handful of deaths in the United States of healthy children who have died from flu already this year, which is much earlier than usual and really quite concerning.
We're talking about flu season with Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent to younger children? How are you feeling about RSV, the flu? Have you seen them showing up in your schools? Are you seeking out vaccines? Have you done so already? What questions do you have about flu season this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about flu season with Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your experiences if you're seeing flu or this RSV pop up among especially kids in your neck of the woods, 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, RSV, we've mentioned it a couple times. People are seeing it in the news. What is it?
Yeah, respiratory syncytial virus is a virus that is fairly devastating to premature infants. And I think that's really where the attention has been for many years. And so there's been ability with some, you know, very expensive products to try to protect them. What we've started to realize over the last 5 to 10 years, as we've been doing more respiratory testing, is that it's also a bad actor for the older part of the population. And in fact, there's some data out there that suggests that RSV is just as bad as influenza for that population over age 65. But it's very similar to all these other respiratory viruses, including COVID. It causes, you know, bad respiratory illness, it causes pneumonia, and then sets you up for secondary bacterial pneumonias because of all that gunk and obstruction that happens from the inflammation. Very contagious, as are both COVID and influenza as well. And I think one of the things we've been starting to recognize is that there are a lot of people who have been cooped up for a long time, get respiratory symptoms, may test themselves for COVID and say, oh, good, I'm COVID negative, and go back out about their regular business. And I think that's part of what's contributing to this rapid spread of both RSV and influenza throughout our communities.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is calling from on the road. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
What'd you want to tell us about, Pat?
Okay, so one of my grandsons, who just started school this year, he ended up getting RSV. I mean, this is a child that was hardly ever sick, you know, until he started in school. It's like he just walked into a cloud. But what's really odd is my wife, everybody except me, got the COVID, and I don't know if that's just because of I'm outside and I'm in it all the time. I don't know. But somebody brought up the statement about taking a massive amount of vitamin D and zinc. Does that help? That's the real reason.
Gotcha.
That's the big thing I'm calling for.
Pat, thanks for the call. Dr. Conway, are there supplements that can help us? I think we all want there to be supplements that can help us avoid all these illnesses. Do we have any proven supplements in our toolkit that you'd point people to?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, zinc, selenium, vitamin C, vitamin B, vitamin D, you know, people have really tried hard to find a good association with improved outcomes. There's a limited amount of data that for zinc and vitamin C that it may shorten the duration of the illness a little bit, but the data hasn't been compelling enough to really make it something that we recommend widely. You know, certainly people that are sick should make sure that they get good nutrition so that they can rebuild and fight these things off. And it is hard to eat and drink. So, you know, taking a vitamin supplement while you're sick is reasonable, but it certainly isn't necessary to take massive doses of these things. And obviously large doses can certainly cause harm as well. But we all wish those things were true, but unfortunately grandma just wasn't correct. Same thing with chicken soup. You know, it's a good way to stay hydrated, but other than that, there's really no magic to it, unfortunately.
Pat, thanks for calling. Best to the grandson, completely, hopefully, getting over this RSV soon. And Dr. Conway, let's talk about the kids now. When should a parent seek medical attention if they're seeing, you know, respiratory problems that, you know, maybe it could be COVID or flu or RSV?
Yeah, I think the key things we look for, especially in the younger kids, you know, rapid breathing is really one of the key features. You know, most people breathe 16 to 24 times a minute. So you'll see these kids that get these bad respiratory viruses that are breathing 30 or 40 times a minute. You know, that's certainly concerning. If that starts to impact their ability to eat and drink, that's another red flag that need to be looked into, because some of these kids need, you know, intravenous fluids. And then high fevers. You know, most of the respiratory viruses, flu and COVID and RSV, can cause some fever. But if you've got sustained fever, those really are worrisome for bacterial superinfections. The other thing is for people that have underlying immune deficiencies or underlying what we call comorbidities, you know, other medical problems that may be at increased risk for having complicated disease. You know, there is treatment for influenza. I mean, obviously we'd like to prevent it as much as we can with vaccines and people being judicious about going out when they're sick. But if you get influenza, you know, oseltamivir, or what's known as Tamiflu, is very effective, but it needs to be started relatively early in the disease. Same thing with COVID. Paxlovid, you know, works nicely to at least prevent people from getting very ill, but you need to start it within those first couple days of the illness. So those are other reasons that people should seek medical attention and testing to see if they can figure out what they've got.
Now, on the prevention side of things, we know we have COVID vaccines out there. We know we have flu vaccine out there. Is there something like that for RSV?
Not yet. I mean, for the premature infants, we have these monoclonal antibody injections that they get every month during the winter season called Synagis. Really inconvenient, very expensive product. And so it's really limited to these high-risk premature infants. But on the horizon, there are vaccines coming for RSV, in particular for the elderly, for people over the age of 65. We're anticipating that there's going to be a number of vaccines that are currently at the FDA being reviewed that are likely to be available sometime during 2023. And then moving forward after that, there's ongoing work that looks very promising for vaccines to give to pregnant moms at the end of the pregnancy to give the baby some immunity, and then even new vaccines that are going to hopefully come out over the next couple of years for kids as well. So I think people have realized for a long time RSV is pretty nasty, and there's been a lot of breakthroughs over these last couple of years in developing vaccines finally. These have been kind of a holy grail of vaccines in my world, at least now for onwards of 20 years. And so we're pretty optimistic that we're going to have some more tools in our tool belt.
On the behavioral side of things, Dr. Conway, what would you hope people do to help avoid getting the three illnesses we're talking about here and to avoid spreading them?
Yeah, it's pretty much everything we've been getting hammered with about through COVID, which is, you know, covering your cough, wear a mask if you do go out, if you have one of these respiratory illnesses. Ideally, try to stay home if you can. Certainly, everybody needs to be washing their hands. But I think we need to really, you know, continue to maintain some of this healthy respect we had for COVID for these other respiratory viruses and try to, you know, be fair to people. I mean, I know everybody's busy and needs to do their holiday shopping and, you know, is back to work in school. But I think we've all had to learn the lesson that if you're sick, you really owe it to others to try to stay home as much as you can and not expose other people. There's a lot of high-risk individuals in our communities that may have really bad outcomes, and none of us want to contribute to that. So those are really the key things that we need to all keep in mind.
And what's your current state of the art on when and where we put on a mask?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly if you have any symptoms when you go out of the house, I think that's important. I think anytime you're in large gatherings with unknown individuals, you know, especially if you're a person who has risk of getting severe disease, you may want to consider it. But I think the key is anybody who actually has any symptoms and needs to go out, they really owe it to other people that they should be the ones wearing the mask. It really is trying to essentially cover your cough and your secretion so that you're not shedding these things all over the place. That's really, in many ways, the most important group, and not really the way we've been thinking about masks. We've been thinking about masks to protect ourselves throughout these last couple of years. But in reality, you know, there's a lot to be gained by protecting other people when you have to go out and have one of these respiratory illnesses. So, you know, I think everybody needs to kind of come up with their own strategy, but I certainly wear them in areas where I'm going to be around a lot of people, you know, airports or large gatherings indoors with people that I don't know, and I don't know how healthy they are, just to be able to maintain and keep myself from getting ill. The other good thing about masks is, you know, they do keep your hands away from your own face. And that's a lot of how people actually acquire these things. You sort of touch a surface that somebody's recently coughed or sneezed on, you scratch your own face, and lo and behold, you've exposed yourself to viruses. So there is something to be said, not only for just filtering the air, but also protecting your face from your own hands from contaminating yourself.
Dr. Conway, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always happy to do so, Rob. Keep up the good work, and I'm a happy sustainer and always will be. So hope others are going to join the crew.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. That's Dr. James Conway, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about flu season, shaping up to be worse than the couple seasons before the pandemic. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The Respect for Marriage Act passed in the U.S. Senate yesterday with a 61-36 vote. 12 Republicans joined Democrats in supporting the bill. If passed, the act would specify some federal protections for same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. That would be especially significant if the U.S. Supreme Court were to overturn a decision that allows same-sex marriage nationwide. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of the lead sponsors of the legislation. She spoke yesterday after the Senate signed or passed the bill.
I know why people felt that they were at risk. And I am so proud to stand beside a bipartisan group of leaders who made a commitment to advance the Respect for Marriage Act, again, while listening so carefully to our colleagues to make sure that concerns and the concerns raised about religious liberties were addressed and that people were heard. So with that, what a great day, which will make a difference in so many millions of people's lives.
That'll now go to the U.S. House, which passed a similar but not identical bill earlier this year. Howard Schwaber is professor of political science at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about what this bill does and doesn't do?
Sure. So the bill does not, let's start from the beginning, does not require all states to recognize same-sex marriages. In fact, it almost certainly couldn't do that. That is beyond the powers of Congress under Article 1 of the Constitution. So the very first starting point is, if Obergefell, that's the Supreme Court decision recognizing same-sex marriage and requiring the states to recognize them, if that case were to be overturned, as some people fear might happen, this law does not have the ability to, the power, let's say, Congress doesn't have the power to restore a national rule of that kind. What this bill does do is says that if one state recognizes same-sex marriage, then a couple married in that state who travel to a different state are entitled to have their marriage recognized, even if in the new state that they're now inhabiting or visiting, same-sex marriages are not allowed.
This also means that the federal government would recognize a same-sex marriage if it was done legally in a state in that situation. Is that important?
Yes, that's correct. It's extremely important. So this law overrules the Defense of Marriage Act, which was a law that said that the federal government, for purposes of benefits in particular, other things as well, but benefits and legal prerogatives, will not recognize a same-sex marriage. Overturning that law now means, and under the terms of the new law, it is now the case that the federal government will recognize as valid, for tax purposes, for benefits purposes, for access to legal records purposes, any marriage that is valid in the state in which it is performed, including same-sex marriages.
Does this really change much of anything right now, as long as that Supreme Court decision you mentioned, Obergefell, remains in effect?
Probably not. There are the one part that has an immediate effect is the overturning of the Defense of Marriage Act, and that's only because that law covers so many things. I've seen an estimate there are 30,000 separate federal benefits or entitlements that come with the federal government recognizing a marriage. So Obergefell certainly meant that the Defense of Marriage Act couldn't be applied broadly in the way it was originally understood, but there were all kinds of detailed questions that hadn't been worked out that are now kind of swept away. So the biggest immediate impact will be on practices by federal agencies and federal entities. In terms of life on the ground, so to speak, not that that doesn't involve people's lives, but in terms of what goes on in the states and who can get married, that is now remains governed by Obergefell. It remains the case that there's a nationally recognized constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry and an obligation for all states to recognize those marriages. So this law is really a safeguard against the possibility of Obergefell being overturned, which is something that Justice Thomas alluded to, for example, in his opinion in the Dobbs case recently.
Right. I wanted to get to that. We had Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, as we heard, a lead sponsor. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson voted against it. One of the reasons he cited was, hey, this Obergefell decision is in place. It's settled law. There's no move to overturn it. People in response said, well, that's what people said about Roe v. Wade a couple years ago. Do you think it would be likely that legal challenges would percolate up from states to the U.S. Supreme Court to potentially overturn Obergefell?
Oh, I think that there is no question that that will happen. This gets to be a long conversation about the Dobbs opinion, the one that overturned Roe versus Wade and what it said and how it's written. But the short version is that opinion is written in a way that absolutely invites challenges to recently recognized rights under the Due Process Clause, including the right of same-sex marriage. I don't mean it only leaves open that possibility. I mean that the majority opinion and the other opinions in the case really are written in a way that issues an invitation to lawyers around the country, come file a suit, come challenge Obergefell, and see what you can get.
Justice Alito, in the majority opinion, says this is just about abortion. This doesn't apply. This isn't precedent for Obergefell. Justice Thomas, in a separate opinion, says, yeah, oh, yeah, it does. Basically, yeah. We can't predict what the U.S. Supreme Court would do. What do you think the arguments would be if it came to that, if a state case came to the U.S. Supreme Court on Obergefell?
Well, Alito, in fact, talks out of both sides of his mouth. He says this is only about abortion, but then the terms in which he describes the right to abortion that is being overturned are carefully framed in order to include things like Obergefell. So rights recognized subsequent to the 1970s, for example, are treated with a special suspicion. The arguments would be that that Dobbs, the Supreme Court case, means that we will not recognize rights as under what's called substantive due process, which is just a name for a way of recognizing rights under the Constitution. Courts will not recognize that type of right, rights that are not listed in the Bill of Rights, that's the key, unless they meet certain conditions and unless the description of that right is one that is part of our longstanding tradition. Well, you can certainly make an argument that recognizing same-sex marriage is not a longstanding tradition in American life, in American history. And really, that's all you have to say to raise at least an argument under Dobbs that Obergefell should be revisited. There are other things in the Dobbs opinion that give other clues or cues even to people wanting to challenge Obergefell how to go about it in a way that Alito at least is likely to find sympathetic. So I think the suggestion that Dobbs can be cabined in a way that it only applies to the right to abortion is really wrongheaded. And it's not just about this case. It's always the case that when a general principle is announced in the context of a specific dispute, the general principle later is applied to other disputes. The other case from the last summer, of course, is the Bruin gun case. That has the same quality. It's about the Second Amendment right to guns, but it's written in a way that invites a whole range of challenges to a whole range of regulations. And we've already begun to see that play out as lower courts are striking down laws that don't fit that case's particular tests. So I think both of those two cases, you know, they got a lot of attention because they were about abortion and guns, which are politically highly salient topics and very much in the news. But their much, much deeper importance is that they announced kind of a pathway or an approach to challenging rights claims and regulatory assertions by government in ways we have not seen before. And that process has not even begun to play itself out.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison's Political Science Department, looking at the Respect for Marriage Act passed the U.S. Senate, protections for same-sex marriage. Howard, some changes made in this to get some Republican support. Republican critics worried, they raised concerns about religious liberties if this law would require religious institutions and others to recognize same-sex marriage. Can you talk about that religious liberty angle?
Sure. It's a big topic. The history goes back to what's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. So what happened was in 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion that said government is not required to make accommodations to religious believers so they don't have to follow laws that contradict their religious beliefs. That was controversial, and Congress responded with something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. That said, no, we are going to insist that the right to free exercise of religion be understood in a way that protects believers against the operation of laws that apply generally. That law was then ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, which said, no, only the court gets to determine what rights are. Congress doesn't get to say what freedom of religion involves. It was all very complicated. Today, there are now RFRA statutes in multiple states. I don't think all states, but the majority of them, as well as one that applies to operations of the federal government. So on the one hand, if you think, for example, about the famous Hobby Lobby case, that was about the federal statute, not the First Amendment. So on the one hand, there is both strong political support and statutory protection for the idea that religious believers should not be required to comply with laws, or at least not unless there's a really, really good reason for it, like preventing child abuse, for example, you know, something on that level. But unless there's a concern on that level, religious believers should not be required to follow laws if doing so would violate their religious principles. On the other hand, as a constitutional principle, that has not been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a kind of middle ground. There are Republicans you're talking about were concerned that if this law didn't include exemptions for religious organizations and religious providers of goods and services, it could be construed by courts to require those organizations and those persons to participate in things like providing decorations or food or photography for a same-sex wedding. And they were very, very eager to shield religious, particularly Christian conservative religious believers from that possibility. So it was a trade-off. I think the liberals and the Democrats and the progressives certainly would have preferred a law that simply required everyone to treat same-sex couples the same way they treat other couples and require a general equality in the marketplace and in treatment by government. There isn't enough bipartisan political support for that kind of general equality guarantee. And this, I think the Democrats accept that as the next best thing.
Looking to the future, if Obergefell, the law, in effect, legalizing same-sex marriage in states that hadn't already legalized themselves, if that were to get overturned, what happens? Do states like Wisconsin go back to the day before that Supreme Court ruling?
Well, it's the same thing as we have seen happen with abortion. So if in Wisconsin, for example, there was a very old 1841 anti-abortion law on the books. After Roe versus Wade, that law was deemed unconstitutional, but it remained there. So that when Dobbs came down and Roe was overturned, that law suddenly went back into effect again. So yes, presumptively, if Obergefell were overturned, everything goes back to status quo ante of the day before it was decided, which in the case of Wisconsin would mean that the state constitutional amendment defining marriage as only between a man and a woman goes back into effect. At that point, we have a very interesting question. So I mentioned that the federal law, the new law, requires states to recognize marriages from out of states, including same-sex marriages or interracial marriages or any other marriage. That's actually in conflict with a long-standing constitutional tradition, which says that where it's a matter of important public policy, states are not required to recognize marriages from other states. In other words, there's something called the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, but that has for a long time consistently been understood not to require one state to recognize another state's marriages. Consider the fact that different states have different age limits, for example. In some states, a person can get married as young as 14. If that person then moves to a state where the age of marriage is 17, I'm making up these numbers, would that second state have to accept that this 14 or 15-year-old is married according to their laws? And the answer has always been no. This federal law proposes to use Congress's Commerce Clause authority to force states to recognize one another's acts of marriage, of licensing marriages. And I have to say, it's not 100% clear that the Roberts Supreme Court would accept even this law as constitutional.
Howard, we'll leave it there. A lot to think about. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the U.S. Senate passing the Respect for Marriage Act yesterday, showing support for same-sex and interracial marriage.